song to show that it's, you know, because I don't know who did this Monongahela song, but it's definitely a ripoff of this melody called Rock a Rumba by Danny and the Delairs. I don't know if this is even going to matter. It doesn't matter in 5 minutes. Most of the stuff doesn't matter. Nothing matters longer than, you know, 100 years is not going to matter. There's 100 seconds. I don't know. I'm just curious. It's like Roger Ebert's face. It's haunting me. I want to do some serious time in hell for this. Okay, let's see. We got Brenda Lee. Rock a little steel guitar. And the Combo Kings, Batman the Go-Go. The Story of Batman, Adam West. It's coming up on 1 o'clock. Time for the WRCT concert calendar. Happening before your very eyes, in your ears. If you have a request, please wait till I'm done telling you it's Shake'em and Knock'em Bacon in the city of Pittsburgh. See, you can see where this is going, right? You get the idea, right? I think we got time for Ungawa Twist.
You know, I think we should play a little music for the nice people listening to us.
Ungawa! Ungawa! Ungawa Twist! Ungawa!
Yeah, you can understand. I can't figure out how this never was a hit. How is Ungawa Twist never a big hit? I don't know. Yeah, I would like to see this recording. You know, whenever I hear a record like this, I just wonder what the recording session looked like. You know? And then I can imagine, like, some teenage kids buying this record and taking it home and playing at a party. You know, everybody's dancing and somebody puts on Ungawa Twist. Good thing or bad thing? There's so many mysterious things in life. It is fascinating, isn't it? But it's not. I guess fascinating might not be the word. Curious, maybe? Unknowable. That's good. Alrighty, time for the concert calendar. And at this point, it is Zombo from the future coming in and talking at you. There is not going to be a concert calendar. That's why the show was originally 5 hours long. What I'm doing is I'm playing Zombo. This is Zombo's Deep Archive. Playing shows from 13 years ago. And 13 years ago, I cannot even fathom this. The show was 5 hours long. I cannot even imagine doing 5 hours of radio, but it was a 5 hour, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours. It was a 5 hour show. So nice thing is, and I did the concert calendar, right? How did I do a 5 hour show? How did I survive doing a, but my regular show now is 3 hours, and that's just the right amount of time. 3 hours, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Fridays right here on the station. But at this time slot next week, tune in. Hopefully, there'll be another Zombo's Deep Archive playing shows from back in the time. And once again, this show originally aired the 14th of May, 2010. It was kind of nice to hear the TurboSonics, Timmy from the TurboSonics, come in and play some nice live tracks of them. So that was a nice little find. So you never know what I'm going to stumble on or what I did 13 years ago. I certainly don't remember. And let's see here. You can go to ZomboCo.com and get a bunch of free downloads and streamings and things of that nature. But until then, this is WRCT Pittsburgh, and as always, I remain in your brain.
Welcome, everybody. Big announcement about the future of the David Pakman Show coming at the end of today's episode. But major, major news. Despite Joe Biden rigging the justice system against his political enemies and in favor of his friends and family, Hunter Biden has been convicted on gun charges and now will face sentencing. Now, I'll be totally honest. I wasn't even going to talk about this. I jokingly tweeted, now that Hunter Biden has been convicted, I definitely won't be voting for him in November. And of course, it's like, what bearing does this have on Joe Biden, particularly since Joe Biden is not intervening or getting involved in any way? But in fact, there is a really newsworthy story here in the context of Trump facing criminal charges and having been convicted already. And that story is the complete and utter hypocrisy, whataboutism, special pleading and conspiracy theorizing that is just everywhere around the Hunter Biden conviction. So let's take it step by step. Why not? We start with a Politico report. Will Hunter Biden go to prison? Here's what happens next after his conviction. And it lays out in very clear detail, Hunter Biden's conviction on three felony gun related charges presents complicated legal and political challenges for his father, Joe Biden, and for the justice system as a whole. What comes next? We, of course, have the same interview with a probation officer that Donald Trump recently sat for. He'll be asked a whole bunch of questions. There will be a report written for the judge, and ultimately we are going to get sentencing. Biden faces a maximum of 25 years in prison for the three counts. The judge has many other options. And typically, I will point out, there is not a prison time for a first offense of this kind. But we will see. I am confident that just like in Trump's case, I guess, the judge will render a reasonable sentence for Hunter Biden as well. So you would think that now that Joe Biden has done nothing to get his son out of trouble, is not intervening in any way, has said he won't be pardoning Hunter Biden, which we'll get to in a moment. Now that all of this has been done, you would think Republicans would say, hey, you know what? The very same Biden Justice Department that oversaw the prosecution of Trump and is overseeing prosecutions of Trump federally went after Hunter Biden. They are going after Bob Menendez, a Democrat. They're going after Henry Cuellar, a Democrat. We have an ethics investigation of Cori Bush, a Democrat. We're ready to say that Joe Biden has not weaponized the justice system against his enemies. No. The new position is that this was all a nonsense, minimal charge against Hunter Biden to make it look as though the system is actually going after people in a bipartisan way. And I even heard that President Biden orchestrated the conviction of his own son in order to justify the criminal charges against his political enemy, Donald Trump. It's a red herring. It's a deliberate distraction. Now, the funny thing about this is you could make exactly the same argument about Donald Trump's 34 guilty verdicts. I mean, Trump will likely get no prison time despite 34 felony guilty verdicts in the first of four criminal trials. If you want to make the argument that this is a facade of accountability, you can make that argument just as strongly about the conviction of Donald Trump so far as you can about Hunter Biden. But let's look at a couple of the reactions. Hardcore MAGA Charlie Kirk, a recruiter of young people to MAGAism, tweeted out, "Hunter Biden guilty, yawn. The true crimes of the Biden crime family remain untouched. This is a fake trial trying to make the justice system appear balanced. Don't fall for it." And a bunch of MAGA types jumped all over this perspective. The failed former MAGA Congressman Madison Cawthorn, who was kicked out of Congress within just one term, tweeted out, quote, "They needed this guilty verdict so the left could rush to the media and pretend there's not a double standard in our justice system. But Hunter will get probation and Biden will try to throw Trump in prison. Just watch." And then we heard from Donald Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, who says Hunter Biden's prosecution was just a distraction.
He knows what this trial with Hunter Biden was about. This is about smoke and mirrors. This is the red herring. This is a distraction from what you've talked about the entire show, which is that it's not just criminality we're worried about with the Biden family. It's national security we're concerned about. We need to know as American citizens that when Joe Biden, as president of the United States, is making decisions for this country, he's made decisions based on what's best for the American people and not what's best for the bank account of the Biden family. And by the way, Sean,
and of course, if there is any president in recent history who makes decisions based on what is best for him and his family rather than the country, it's the failed former president, convicted felon Donald Trump. So think about the facts as we know them here. In the Hunter Biden case, we had a Trump appointed prosecutor. Biden kept that prosecutor through the investigation of his own son, not interfering. Republicans wanted that prosecutor. Lara Trump popping back up. Republicans wanted that prosecutor made special counsel. Joe Biden did it. They brought indictments. Biden did not interfere. He was convicted on all counts with a Delaware jury pool where the Bidens are from. And you would think, oh, these are rigged juries where they're never going to. They convicted him on every single count. A Trump appointed judge presided over the case. And importantly, Joe Biden has said he will not pardon. He will not pardon his son, which Donald Trump in a similar situation obviously would do. It's getting very difficult to make the case that there is political bias in favor of Hunter Biden here. Let's talk about Joe Biden's reaction next. Within minutes of the full slate of guilty verdicts against Hunter Biden yesterday, radical and repugnant reactionary Congresswoman Lauren Boebert tweeting out some very, very hard stuff, saying, quote, Hunter Biden was proven guilty. How long until dear old dad gets involved and fixes this all up for him? These are extraordinarily stiff allegations coming from Lauren Boebert, particularly since Joe Biden said himself just days ago he's not going to get involved. He's going to respect the decision of the jury. He's not going to be pardoning his son, Hunter Biden. Take a look at this. He is on the record saying it. But these MAGA types don't care. They'll whatever they can say, which really should be applied to Trump, they will say. But listen to this from Joe Biden's weekend interview with David Muir.
Your son, Hunter, is on trial. And I know that you cannot speak about an ongoing federal prosecution. But let me ask you, will you accept the jury's outcome, their verdict, no matter what it is?
Yes.
And have you ruled out a pardon for your son?
Yes.
He has ruled out a pardon for Hunter Biden. Joe Biden has many things that we could say are deficits or that we don't like. He didn't do enough of this. He didn't do enough of that. But Joe Biden knows that the rule of law is too important to our democracy for him to jump in and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to pardon Hunter Biden, even though, and this is an incredible thing, if you want to talk about prosecutorial discretion, if you want to talk about crimes or alleged crimes for which individuals are usually not prosecuted, what Hunter Biden did, the trying to obtain a firearm, even though it was illegal for him to do so, almost none of the instances of that are prosecuted. The prosecutorial discretion, when you look at Trump and when you look at Hunter Biden, is very biased against Hunter Biden. I looked at numbers. There is a 10-year period during which only 0.05% of those who did what Hunter Biden did were actually prosecuted. Usually, you would not be prosecuted for what Hunter Biden did. I'm not saying you shouldn't be. We need to take very seriously our gun laws. Part of the problem is we don't. And Republicans don't want to, by the way. But if you want to talk about prosecutorial discretion, if anything, Hunter Biden's the one who got railroaded. I'm not making any defense. I'm merely pointing that out. But Joe Biden realizes you can't get involved in that way. And after the conviction, President Joe Biden putting out the following statement, quote, as I said last week, I am the president, but I am also a dad. Jill and I love our son. We are so proud of the man he is today. So many families who have had loved ones battle addiction understand the feeling of pride seeing someone you love come out the other side and be so strong and resilient in recovery. As I also said last week, I will accept the outcome of this case and will continue to respect the judicial process as Hunter considers an appeal. Jill and I will always be there for Hunter and the rest of our family with our love and support. Nothing will ever change that. Can anyone in my audience genuinely and honestly say that you can imagine Donald Trump putting out such a statement if Donald Trump Jr. or Eric Trump or Ivanka or whoever were convicted in a criminal situation like this one? Can any of you say that this is how Donald Trump would react? Of course not. Trump would react by attacking the judge, the prosecutors, the jury, the entire system, framing himself and his family as the biggest victims in the world, referring to Donald Trump Jr. as a kid, even though he's almost 50, saying he's a good kid and pretending that they're going after a toddler at the end of the day. That's how Donald Trump would react. So a notable difference. And if you want to see differences between reactions to the Trump verdict and the Hunter Biden verdict, look no further than Fox News. And that's what we're going to talk about next. CNN actually did something interesting yesterday after the Hunter Biden guilty verdicts. They did a side by side comparison of how did Fox News talent, I hate to use that term, but I think you know what I'm saying, on air people, on air personalities. How did Fox News on air personalities react when Donald Trump was convicted versus when Hunter Biden was convicted? I think that you will find that their reactions to Hunter Biden's conviction, which we're going to look at here in a moment, starting with Judge Jeanine Pirro and look at others, their reactions to the Hunter Biden conviction really should have been their reactions to Trump's conviction, but they weren't. Take a look at this montage put together by CNN.
This is a new era in America, and I think it goes against the ilk of who we are as Americans and our faith in the criminal justice system. In the end, this jury of ordinary people from Delaware were not intimidated by that family, and they recognized that this was a clear-cut case and that clearly no one's above the law.
And of course, you could apply that to Trump. Those 12 jurors were not intimidated by the fact that they were rendering a verdict on a former president of the United States. They weren't intimidated by that. They looked at the facts and they put together the verdict. All right, here's another guy on Fox side by side.
This is a very political exercise, and you have to say that it accomplished what it set out to accomplish. But I would say this about Judge Nureka. I think she ran a very fair courtroom. She ran a very fair trial.
I guess we all need to shop at Banana Republic from now on? Because that's what it feels like. Yeah, a Banana Republic.
For years, the Bidens have been able to escape any legal accountability for their sleazy, corrupt conduct. But today, their luck ran out. At least Hunter's did.
Power is all they love. And they're willing to do anything to cling to it. They're willing to destroy the rule of law. The Republic has been wounded by weak lawyers and talentless political bloodhounds.
It gave me a little boost of confidence in the American legal system, although they still have a lot of work to do to win me back.
I believe that there was a conscious collusion of allies that came together. It's pretty obvious, with a private strategy to eliminate a common shared adversary. Hunter's going to jail so Joe doesn't have to. And when he comes out, he'll be rewarded for his loyalty like a made man in a Biden crime family. This is a distraction from the influence peddling and the kickbacks.
Yeah. So as you can see there, dramatically different reactions on the conviction of Donald Trump versus the conviction of Hunter Biden. Once again, if you believe that the judge in the Trump trial did something wrong, you can appeal on that basis. In looking at respected legal experts and analysts, I don't see anything that you could say is worthy of a successful appeal unless you want to make the case that this was really at the core what should have been a federal case and not brought at the state level. But of course, that has nothing to do with Judge Merchan. That would be a bigger issue that you could take up on appeal. So this is exactly what we expected. They are going to use this rather than to say, hey, you know what? Maybe the justice system is kind of working okay. And it went after two individuals with different politics. We don't know of any political interference. We don't really know of any wrongdoing. Maybe we step back and we just vote in November. And by the way, Hunter Biden's not even on the ballot. No, that's not what they say. Instead, they have to try to say everything was wrong with the Trump prosecution and conviction, and everything was right with Hunter Biden's. They are blinded, blinded by ideology, and quite frankly, blinded by ignorance as well, if you see the sort of stuff that's spreading. Let's take a very quick break. We're going to hear from a sponsor or two. After the break, we will look at the anatomy of a propaganda operation, and it relates to that debunked Wall Street Journal article about Joe Biden's a brain. We will talk about that next. We are going to look at the architecture, the framework, the anatomy of a propaganda operation. We've done this before. Before Tucker Carlson got fired from Fox News, I would sometimes go through how a completely harebrained conspiratorial opinion becomes, quote, the news on Fox News. And the way it would often happen is Tucker would go on TV at 8 or 9 p.m. or 10 p.m. I don't remember what time he was on. And he's an opinion show. Remember, there's the Fox News people and the Fox opinion people. And Tucker would say something like, it's very clear at this point that the FBI set up the January 6th riots, for example, something crazy like that. And then the next morning on Fox and Friends, the Fox and Friends people, who are sort of like halfway between news and opinion, I would argue they're basically opinion, but I think Fox considers them kind of more on the news side. They would say Tucker Carlson last night argued that the FBI obviously planned the riots. Here's a clip from Tucker from last night. So now you take Tucker's unhinged opinion, you inject it into something that is like pseudo news. And then you get to the noon news hour on Fox News. And at this point, it's been 12 hours of Tucker suggesting the FBI planned January 6th and Fox and Friends referring to the fact that Tucker did. And then now it's completely indistinguishable from just some harebrained conspiracy that Tucker floated the night before. And that's how they turn the propaganda and conspiracies into something that tricks people into plausibly being news. Something very similar happened with Sinclair broadcast stations, which are all over the country owned by Sinclair, local news stations, and the Wall Street Journal piece on Joe Biden's brain, which has now been widely debunked. Now, as I told you guys when the story came out, I believed that it was worthy of reporting on the fact that the story was written. Most of you agreed with me. Some people were angry that I even told you about the story. The reason being that the allegations were at least plausibly better sourced than some of the Trump just saying Biden doesn't know what day it is stuff. Annie Linsky, despite working for the right wing Wall Street Journal, is a reporter with a relatively trustworthy track record. I mentioned in the reporting some of the sourcing seems a little suspect, but I want you to know the story is out there. There's a bunch of holes in it. We're going to continue to cover it. The next day, the story was debunked and I came to you and we discussed that. However, on Sinclair stations, they used the Wall Street Journal piece, which was extraordinarily widely debunked by the time that a lot of these stories went to air. They gave the same damn script to every station, and it led to the exact same monologues. Different anchors all across the country making the exact same point. This is how these organizations spread these propaganda stories. Aaron Rupar and Judd Legum have a great piece about this, which we're linking to. Take a look at this.
The Wall Street Journal calling into question the mental fitness of President Joe Biden. His national correspondent Matt Gelka tells us the issue could decide the election.
Wall Street Journal has published a story which calls the mental fitness of President Biden into question. As national correspondent Matt Gelka tells us, the issue could be an election decider.
Should he be on that or any ballot? The Wall Street Journal is out with new reporting calling into question the mental fitness of President Joe Biden.
Same script all across the country, article debunked.
As national correspondent Matt Gelka tells us, the issue could be an election decider.
As the Wall Street Journal is out with reporting calling into question the mental fitness of President Biden. We want to know, are you worried about President Biden's mental fitness? As national correspondent Matt Gelka tells us, the issue could be an election decider.
As the Wall Street Journal is out with new reporting calling into question the mental fitness of President Joe Biden.
And as national correspondent Matt Gelka tells us, the issue could be an election decider.
Lawmakers think this can be an election decider.
Just the Wall Street Journal is out with reporting calling info into question the mental fitness of President Joe Biden. As national correspondent Matt Gelka tells us, the issue could be an election decider.
And the reason they keep talking about Matt Gelka is then they cut to a package. They cut to a package of Matt Gelka every single one of these stations.
The November election just 3 months away and President Joe Biden's mental fitness being questioned once again. According to a Wall Street Journal report, members in both political parties have serious concerns about his cognitive ability. National correspondent Matt Gelka has more on those concerns.
The Wall Street Journal is out with reporting.
Okay, you get it. I could play 4 more minutes of this stuff for you, but it's every single one of these scripts is the same. I have been talking for more than a decade on this program about how your local news is not really local in many cases. Generically, your half hour local news, which is sort of 30 minutes loosely, you take out 8 minutes of commercials, you have 22 minutes left. Of those 22 minutes, often close to a third of that is weather. Weather is actually local, fine. But you can also find out your weather in 15 seconds by looking at your smartphone. You take out the weather from the 22 minutes and you often have 16 or 15 minutes left. Often a full half to two thirds of the 15 minutes of actual news on local news is national stuff. Either a package, if it's an ABC affiliate station from ABC or whatever, or in the case of Sinclair stations, it is a regurgitation of some script written for every single one of these stations to read. And the reason this is so pernicious, and Aaron and Judd talk about this in the public notice piece that we're linking to, it's very clever to disguise the Wall Street Journal hit piece as local news because people tend to trust local news way more. They don't realize it's not really the local news. In general, we hear people don't trust the news. They're usually thinking of corporate and national news. But when you ask them about your local news, your local NBC affiliate, local Fox affiliate, they trust it far, far more. And so when they are getting the Biden story delivered by their local anchor, they trust it way more. Now, as a practical matter, does anyone in my audience watch this local news now? Like I genuinely, personally, I don't know anyone under 65 that's watching this stuff. Clearly, some people are because it's a very effective and powerful tactic. So my question to you is, are any of you watching these local news stations? And part of the reason I think the answer is also no, is I think if you were watching the local news and you saw that piece, at least some of you would have emailed me and would have said, hey, that propaganda piece that's already been debunked by The Wall Street Journal, it's made it into my local news. The architecture and anatomy of disseminating propaganda. Hey, this is very interesting. Trump's incoherence at his rallies has gone completely mainstream, and reporters from NPR and PBS are now talking about the fact that Donald Trump is making no sense at his rallies, alluding to the brain issues that many mental health and neurology experts have been outlining to you on this program for years. This is actually a really good thing to see. Here is a clip from last night where you will hear reporters talking about the lack of coherence of Trump at rallies. And you know it, I know it, he's glitching all the time.
Saudi Arabia and Russia will repeat do.
Will repeat do, ah. I like that one. Will repeat do, ah. Anyway, they're talking about it and this is good news.
For all his calls for President Biden to undergo some kind of cognitive test, it's clear to say Mr. Trump's remarks are not at all coherent in these rallies.
Mr. Trump's remarks have never been super coherent in his rallies. I'm not sure that I can weigh in on how much they have veered in the last couple of months, but this split screen has always been there, will always be there.
Yeah. So this is just one little story, but I think it is a really important and great thing to have out there simply because the more people that are aware of it, the better. You'll remember, and I'm sorry for playing this clip again, Trump went on an 85-second rant in Las Vegas on Saturday or Sunday that really is impossible to decipher. And this is the sort of incoherence that they're talking about here.
Very short period of time. So I said, let me ask you a question. And he said, nobody ever asked this question. And it must be because of MIT, my relationship to MIT. Very smart. He goes, I say, what would happen if the boat sank from its weight and you're in the boat and you have this tremendously powerful battery and the battery is now underwater and there's a shark that's approximately 10 yards over there?
Yeah.
By the way, a lot of shark attacks lately. Do you notice that? A lot of shark. I watched some guys justifying it today. Well, they weren't really that angry. They bit off the young lady's leg because of the fact that they were not hungry, but they.
So I won't play the whole thing for you. But what I do want to point out is that when they talk about Biden mumbling or stuttering as a guy who's had a lifelong stutter or sometimes pausing and kind of recollecting or regathering his thoughts, that may very well be. A symptom of age-related slowing down, as people on this show, mental health experts have pointed out. This is a completely different sort of incoherence. This is the incoherence of someone who seems completely delusional about the world around them. And good for PBS NewsHour and good for the NPR reporters that are talking about this. It is a very real story. And the more people that know about it, the more people that will be able to, if Trump actually shows up to the debate on June 27th, evaluate his ranting and raving for what it is, which is these are not carefully crafted attacks. This is not Trump demonstrating an understanding of any particular issue on any level of depth that we might hope for. These are just delusional and confused rantings of a guy who understands less and less. And just compare Trump's interviews today with those of 4 years ago. The difference is truly stunning. And it's because it's been a linear decline. There are some arguing that it is an accelerating decline. It may be starting to accelerate. But if you look back 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, and these interviews from Letterman and other places, it's been a linear decline for Trump that is very different to what we're seeing with Biden. So, as I said before, worst case scenario, if they're both demented, Biden's done an extraordinary job for a demented president. And I still would rather the people around him running the country. If we're honest about this, something is very wrong with the convicted felon, failed former president. We have not talked about polling for a little while, have kind of been waiting for the post-conviction polling to settle a bit. And we now have some news, and it's all pretty bad for Donald Trump. I don't know any other way to say it. This doesn't change my generic view that this will probably still come down to 500,000 votes in 3 to 5 states. But I would be doing you a disservice if I didn't tell you that some of these numbers are shifting. Newsweek has an article, Donald Trump suffers quadruple polling blow, and it outlines a number of concerning developments for the convicted felon failed former president. And it points out Newsweek has compiled at least 4 results from recent surveys that may be concerning to Trump. Trump's spokesperson Stephen Chung told Newsweek President Trump continues to lead crooked Joe Biden across polling averages nationally and in battleground states. That may be true. We could look at that in a moment. However, a CBS News YouGov survey shows Trump narrowly ahead of Biden 50 to 49. But when you break the results down into the 7 swing states, which will likely be vital, the results reverse and it's Biden 50, Trump 49. Now, you might say, David, that's not that good. And it's kind of the same Trump by one, Biden by one. The key thing is that a month ago, Donald Trump was clearly leading in at least 5 of those 7 critical states, if not even more. And this looked at a number of those important states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, with normal margins of error. The next part of the quadruple polling blow for the post-conviction Trump is independents. The same CBS News YouGov poll found Trump is slightly behind Biden in terms of support from potentially key demographics of independent voters. They prefer Biden by 2 points, 50 to 48. Another poll, Yahoo News YouGov, found 41% of independents support Biden versus 38% for Trump. The reason that's important is we recently saw in a totally different poll that independents have been significantly impacted by the verdict. And when you combine last week's polling that something like half of independents believe Trump should just drop out of the race after being convicted, you then see Biden take a +3 lead in multiple different polls among independents. That is not a particularly good result if you are Donald Trump. Part 3 is Biden records his highest scores in 10 months. In the same Yahoo News YouGov poll, Biden overtook Trump 46 to 44, leading the race for the first time since October of 2023. This is less about the number. 2 is still within the margin of error, but it's about the reversal in momentum here. And then lastly, voters are leaning more towards Biden on the economy. And I want to make sure I'm clear on this one, because it is true that on average, in most polls, Trump is ahead on the economy. And Trump is still ahead in this poll from the Financial Times University of Michigan on the economy, but by a much smaller margin than there has been. Trump was leading Biden by 11 points on the economy 4 months ago. and Trump now only leads by 4. And of course, this was one of the predictions that we had, which is as we get closer to Election Day, if indeed the economy stays as strong as it is. Oh, David, how can you say that? Eggs are still more expensive than they were 5 years ago. Yeah, that's not going to change because we're not heading towards a deflationary spiral. And to a degree, we should be happy about that, although that doesn't. Not to discount the effect of high prices on folks, but it is true that we don't want a deflationary spiral. It's bad for the economy. The degree to which the economy numbers favor Trump is diminishing. And as you all know, because I've said it so many times now, in general, American presidents get themselves reelected. Trump has been the exception. And before Trump, you've got to go back to 1992 for the last president who didn't get reelected when running for reelection, George H.W. Bush. Presidents in general get reelected when the economy has sustained low unemployment, sustained 3% GDP growth, wages outpacing inflation, inflation at 3%. In general, in those scenarios, it's even more likely that presidents get themselves reelected. So this is all good for Joe Biden and bad for Donald Trump. But David, what about the young people furious with Joe Biden over his, quote, handling of Israel-Gaza? Well, let's not ignore that issue. Let's talk about that next. Despite claims that young people have completely abandoned Joe Biden because of his, quote, handling of the Israeli-Gaza war, he is still polling really well with young people. There is a new report. Joe Biden leads Trump by 25 points among younger people. There are some important details here, which we will be discussing. A new poll gives Biden the edge over Trump with youngsters. Those are voters 18 to 29. This was done by Yahoo News and YouGov. And it gives Biden a 25-point lead among 18 to 29-year-olds when it comes to the election in November. In the Yahoo News, in the Yahoo YouGov survey from June 3 to 6, Biden's lead remained slight overall, but widened when the poll showed young voters' level of support. Listen, here's my view on this. Are there young voters mad at Biden about his handling of Israel-Gaza? Yes, there are. We know that there are. We know that there is this uncommitted movement, which really was notable mostly only in Michigan. We know that this exists anecdotally. We know that anecdotally, there are former Trump voters who plan to vote for Biden. We know that anecdotally, there are people who will vote for whoever Bernie endorses, right? There, anecdotally, there are all of these things. Big picture, I don't want to go by what I see on Reddit or Twitter, because that led me astray in 2020. As many of you know, and I say this as a Bernie supporter in 2016 and 2020, if I were led by what I saw on Twitter or Reddit in 2020, I would have assumed Bernie is going to run away with this nomination. The Democratic Party overwhelmingly supports Bernie. And what we learned, and it was instructive and it was useful for strategy and for thinking of the path forward, we learned that a lot of Democratic voters aren't on Reddit and Twitter. They're just working, raising their families, bringing their kids to soccer or football, as we call it in some other parts of the world. And then they go out and they vote and they liked Biden. And similarly, if you spend time on TikTok or on X or whatever platform, you are getting a truncated and limited view of what's going on out there. And when I look at polling, I find that Biden still has a massive lead among young people. Young people vote, by the way, at far lower numbers than any other age group. And that will probably be the case again in November, to be totally honest, although I want them to vote. And number three, when they are asked to rank their issues in order of importance, foreign policy broadly or Israel-Gaza specifically ranks 10th, 15th, or sometimes not at all in terms of issues. So that doesn't mean we don't care. It doesn't mean we don't consider or try to appeal to this group or that group. We do all of those things. But I think it's important to be realistic also about the degree to which this is going on. Now, then when we step back from that, we say, hey, you know, if it's going to be as close as it probably will be, coming down to 250 to 500,000 votes in 3 to 5 states, 2 to 5 states even,
Shouldn't we care about that slice of Democrats that's young and that's angry with Biden about Israel, Gaza? Of course we should care about them. We should care about all of these groups. The question is, how much of your limited resources and time do you focus on going after that group, which statistically is least likely to show up anyway in the best case scenario, versus targeting other groups, and also in which states, when Michigan seems to be the one state in which this even maybe be a plausible, real, more major factor. So I don't have the answer to that. I'm not a political strategist or someone expert at directing campaign resources. It seems that you would direct some resources towards it, but you would direct them proportional to the lead you already have among voters, 18 to 29, the fact that they're likely to less likely to show up and vote anyway, and the fact that even they rank Israel Gaza as 10th, 15th, or not even ranking at all. So where that leaves us, I don't know. After the break, what we are going to look at is an anecdote. So, punched my mic there, and I apologize. I'm getting very agitated here. One of the things that we look at is we zoom out, and that's what we're doing with national polls. After the break, we're going to zoom in and look at one district in Ohio and the stunning turn of events that we're seeing there. Please make sure that you're subscribed to the YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheDavidPackmanShow. We're going to take the quickest of quick breaks and then the show will continue. Republicans are experiencing a red alert shockwave this morning because of something that happened in a Republican district in Ohio. It is delightful. And I have to tell you, it's not all that surprising. I'll explain in a moment. Newsweek reports Ohio election shock as Republican district shifts 20 points to Democrats. A Republican district in Ohio has shifted 20 points to Democrats in the state's latest special election. Republican state senator Michael Rooley defeated Democrat Michael Kripchak to win the election held in Eastern Ohio 6th District Tuesday to fill a vacancy left by Bill Johnson, who resigned in January. While he won by some 10 points, 54 to 45, it's really 9 points, the results mark a decline in Republican support in Ohio's 6th District compared to previous elections. Johnson won his last four elections by more than 30 percentage points. Trump won the battleground state by 8 in 2016 and 2020. This is a huge, huge seat. This was a seat that was plus 29 or 30 for Republicans over recent years. And this time they won by only 10. Now, you might say, David, I don't really understand the significance of this. And I would understand that because it's not totally obvious. When you see the presidential margin in some of these districts, Trump himself won this area by 29. Okay. And then a Republican candidate defeats a Democrat by, they're calling it 10, but it's really 9.3. You have to wonder what is going on here. What would be happening in a big Republican district where Republicans historically won by 30, Trump won it by 29, and all of a sudden, a Republican wins by only 9.3. This would be like if Biden were to win California, but only by 2 points. He still would win it, but you would be saying, wait a second, this is like the bluest of blue strongholds. And Biden's only able to win it by 2, that signals trouble. Now, we also have to be kind of cautious and recognize that Republicans have lost everything since Trump squeaked into the White House in 2016. But that doesn't mean they're not going to be able to win in November anyway and squeak back in. Admittedly, Biden also squeaked in. And what I mean by that is in 2016, electorally, had Hillary Clinton found about 77,000 votes in three states, she would have won electorally. She won the popular vote, goes by Electoral College. She would have won if 77,000 votes in three states went a different way. Similarly, in 2020, Joe Biden won thanks to only about 125,000 votes in three states. Had 125,000 people in three states voted a different way, despite losing the popular vote by millions and millions, Trump could have become president by winning the Electoral College. So the big story, if we are to zoom out here, is that after barely winning in 2016, the 2018 midterms were not good for Republicans. The 2020 presidential election was not good for Republicans. the 2022 red wave that never materialized actually led to Democrats growing their majority in the Senate. The 2023 off-year elections were very bad for Republicans. Every abortion-related referendum since the overturning of Roe v. Wade has been an absolute disaster. And anecdotally, including when we look at districts like this, we are seeing signs that November could be an absolute and total disaster for Republicans. Ro Khanna, the congressman, told us on the show last week, he believes that the House is very much in play for Democrats to take over. None of it matters if we don't vote. And what we have to understand is the polling and all of these signs, these aren't indicators about what will happen regardless. These are suggestions about what could happen if we actually get out and vote and the election results in November reflect the will of the people. We can all want these to be the results. The perspective of the country can very much be, if we all have our voices heard, Republicans will do really terribly. But unless we actually go out and vote and make it a reality, none of it matters. And that's the critically important thing. A very bad sign for Republicans there in Ohio. All right. Time for a big announcement. And there's really no easy way to say this. This has been in discussion for a very long time. I've been agonizing over it. We've been discussing it as a team. And I have made the decision in consultation with our team, friends and family, advisors, rabbis. Actually, I don't know if I talked to any rabbis about this one. Maybe one. I have made the decision that effective at the start of August, the David Pakman radio and TV show is going to end. And that is going to be it. Now, if you are used to listening to the audio podcast or watching clips on YouTube or watching clips on TikToks or TikTok or TikTok or whatever, or basically online, this is actually very good news for you because it's going to lead to more content from you. If you listen on the radio, watch on any of our TV affiliates or watch on Free Speech TV, this means the show is going away for you. And you are going to, if you want to continue watching or listening to the show, you're going to have to find a different way to do it, which includes any of our online platforms. Let me explain to you why we're doing this. When this show started, it started as a radio show. And it started on community radio stations. It expanded to community television stations. It expanded to satellite TV. Over the years, and the show has been around for a long time now, 18 years, over the years, the importance of those platforms has diminished. The amount of staff time required to service those platforms has not diminished. In fact, it's probably gone up. And the interference that being on those platforms causes for our online platforms has become more and more significant. You know, some people will sometimes ask me, David, why don't you put the whole interview on the podcast and have a longer podcast that day? And the answer is because of our radio and TV affiliates who need a 57-minute show every single day. And so if I've got a good 80 or 90 minutes one day because of a great interview, we have to chop the interview up, divide it into two shows, only put the interview online. And we get a lot of complaints about that. In addition to this, we often have to curtail language, bleep things. Sometimes we forget to bleep and then we cause a problem for affiliate stations. There's a lot of little things as well as the generation of additional files and so many different things. And to be honest, there's also a financial component where we've been producing the show for radio and TV at our cost, and it generates essentially zero revenue for us. And so this is a business decision as well as a decision about the future of media. I believe the future, especially for shows like this, is on digital platforms, especially now as people have Bluetooth in their cars, have all of these different forms of technology. So it has been a tough decision. There are people who are going to be upset. I know that that's the case. And every time we make a change, some people are upset and we're going to have to deal with that. But the radio and television show is going to be going away. Now, this is not the only change that is coming to the David Pakman show, and I can't yet speak to all of the changes that we're going to be making. Some of the new things that are now going to be possible are, on some days, the show is just going to be longer. So for those who are just like, give me a longer show if there's a longer show, when we have our longer 30-minute interviews, that day, the show may be an hour and 20 minutes or an hour and 30 minutes. It's just what it is. we are going to test some new formats. We typically have not done any kind of multi-guest shows where I might bring on two guests with opposing views. Part of the reason is we're thinking backwards from our affiliates need a 57-minute show. If I have two guests on and it's only 12 minutes, it doesn't really allow for a full discussion, so we just don't do it. So one of the things we're going to start dabbling with is we may have discussions with multiple guests on the show. We may have discussions where I am interviewing two guests at the same time, or there may be a roundtable, and maybe there will be an entire show one day, which is some kind of panel or an in-person event. Or all of these things will now be possible. The other thing is some of you have noticed that the last 2 weeks, there have not been live calls on the Friday show. And no decision has yet been made about this, but I'll be very upfront with you that we are testing getting rid of live calls. I know that there are the people who call in would be upset if we stop the live calls. The live calls are the segment we get the most complaints about. There's a lot of people who don't even listen to the Friday show because they hate live calls. And I'm going to be honest, the live calls are not the highest quality. It takes a bunch of technical problems, meandering statements rather than questions, and a lot of confusion to get to one good call. And we get a ton of complaints, and the calls, only one out of 50 really generates what I would consider to be really good discussion. So we are testing what is the show like if we don't do the live calls. And we may do them, we may not. We're in the middle of a 3 or 4 week test. It's what we're doing because I want to make the show as good as possible. And I don't want to have any segments on the show that I consider to be kind of like dead weight. And one of the things we've been talking a lot, including with other creators, about is just because there are things that I've done for a while, like, for example, take live calls because it seems natural to hear from people in that way. Maybe the live calls aren't a good fit for The Daily Show. In addition to not having the live calls on the podcast over the last 2 weeks, I have done 3 weeks in a row of a weekly TikTok call-in show. And I have to tell you, the questions on TikTok have been significantly higher quality. We've had fewer technical issues. It allows me to do a full hour of conversation with the audience rather than just 20 minutes. And it's gone really, really well. So another possibility is maybe the live calls, if they don't come back to the full show, maybe they go to a weekly live on TikTok. That's another possibility. I want to hear from you about it. And I understand that all of these things I'm mentioning, there are people who are going to be absolutely furious about. And it just sort of like comes with the territory. Every time we change the show music, there's blowback and all of these things. The other thing I want to mention is there is another opportunity, which is, as some of you know, we have had people on the show who have done kind of like person on the street, go and do some interviews, that have gone on and launched into really great media production careers. Luke Beasley and Adam Mockler and people that were doing that on this show really early. We want to see about, and I don't know if it's going to be on the podcast, on TikTok, where it's going to end up. We want to see about on a more regular basis involving people in these person on the street segments for us. If you want to do interviews on camera with people, ideally people with different points of view, similar to what Luke Beasley or The Good Liars or Jordan Klepper do, we have an opportunity. And so what I would love for you to do is send somewhat of an audition reel tape. And I know some people will say, David, I'm not doing any work for free. Totally fine. The only way for us to vet whether there's a good shot at you being able to do this is to see if you're able to do it. So send us about 5 minutes total of footage, ideally featuring you interviewing people in the format that Luke and others do. You can upload it as an unlisted YouTube video and send me the link. The footage can be real time or unedited. You can also make it more of an edited highlight reel if you want. And if you just do whatever really shows us your talent in no more than 5 minutes. Doesn't have to be at a political event. You don't have to go to a Trump rally. The idea is somewhere with foot traffic, talking to people with political views that are different than yours. This ideally could become a regular paid gig for one or more people after the audition. Okay. This audition is going to be like the great filter because I expect a lot of people just won't do it the right way. And so this is the opportunity. We don't yet know. It is a paid gig. We don't yet know everywhere that it would appear, but this is something that we are starting to test. So we're going to be testing some panel interviews on the show. We're going to be testing some debates. We're going to be testing some person on the street stuff. We may be getting rid of live calls. I don't know. It's an iterative process. The show continues to evolve. But again, the big news here, I know that a lot of our affiliates are not pleased, but it's a decision we have to make for what's best for the show and for the audience. And 99.2% of the audience, we believe, is online. We will be ending the radio and television show. Hilariously, I know that some of you will say, what radio and television show? I didn't even know there was one. Don't even worry about it then. You don't have to worry. All right. So major news for the show. The next iteration, the next chapter will start. I believe it's August. Let's see. The final radio show will be August 2nd. And the new David Pakman show will launch on August 5th. So that's where we are. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a caller with a problem. He's got MAGA in-laws. Take a listen.
Hey, David. What's going on, man? Jack from New York. Listen, got a little bit of a question for you. In-laws are big-time MAGAs.
Yep.
Wife relatively politically uninformed, but just leans toward where her parents lean. That's all well and good. However, stakes are high in the election. Curious to get your take. Do I be forthright with my selection? Or do I keep it under wraps and just say, no, it's a tough choice, blah, blah, blah. They're both pretty bad. Thanks, man.
Listen, the key piece of information that this caller didn't tell me is what state do your MAGA in-laws vote in, right? If your MAGA in-laws vote in South Carolina or they vote in California, it's probably not worth risking ruining your relationship with them to confront them about their disgusting political views. I mean, it's if you care, it's, the caller clearly cares about the relationship with his in-laws. So he's saying, is it worth confronting them? And if so, in what way, given that it might sour the relationship? Well, part of it is, could their vote even conceivably make a difference? That's a practical answer. Now, for moral or ethical reasons, I could understand, you know, if in-laws have these views that are completely antithetical to everything you believe in, it might not be about are their votes going to make a difference. It's just about, can I tolerate not calling them out for views that I think are deplorable? Only you can make that decision. And I've said this to people before. You have to work backwards from what sort of relationship you want to maintain and decide whether you want to do some kind of confrontation, especially if it's in states that are likely to be deciding states in the election. It's not a terrible thing to say, I'm just going to kind of keep the peace. So let me know the way it shakes out. We've got a great bonus show for you today.
At the end of the day, we're going to beat these people.
We're not going to let Alex Jones beat us, and the bonus show will continue. Trump could and would shake up American foreign policy if he wins. What would be the big changes? We'll discuss them. The Biden administration has announced a plan for removing medical debt from credit reports. This is another big deal. And a Connecticut town is going to pay a $100,000 settlement after a teacher showed a Kendrick Lamar video in school. What is going on in this school? What is the big deal? What happened? We will discuss all of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Don't miss it. Sign up at joinpakman.com. I have new crime data to share with you today, and it may not shock some of you that we continue to see a sustained and pervasive decline in crime, all kinds of crime in the United States. The reason it might not be surprising to you, but it would be surprising to the regular consumers of Fox News and other right-wing media, is that one of the greatest stories that has been told over the last few years, in the absence of any serious criticisms of the Biden administration, is that it's really dangerous out there. Carjackings and sexual assaults and murder and all categories of crime that, of course, still exist in a country of 340 million people, but continue to decline, much broader decline, by the way, than anything we would just say is thanks to Joe Biden. but continuing to see these declines during the Biden administration. Now, they've already got their talking points. They've already got their rebuttals. We're going to go through them one by one so that you can be prepared and we can really kind of think through whether any of the criticisms of these data are valid. But starting at the top, ABC News reports FBI's latest data shows historic drop in crime. Reported incidents of violent crime dropped 15% according to the FBI data. When you read into this further, you see that this applies to really all types of crime. Murder down 26%. And you can go and read through it, property crime, all sorts of different crime. So why is it that we see this and yet 26% reduction in murder, 25% reduction in rapes, 13% reduction in aggravated assaults, 18% reductions in robberies? And yet this is not going to be convincing to the crowd that insists it's more dangerous than ever out there. And if they can somehow blame undocumented immigrants or documented immigrants, whatever, they'll blame whoever they can if they can get away with it. Why is this the case that we continue to hear these talking points from them? Well, part of it is they don't really have that much else to offer. And so they have to insist that crime is up. But let's talk through some of their rebuttals. One thing that you will see is, you know, David, you said this is based on reported crime. The truth is, they will argue, crime rates are actually up, but people are so disgusted with the sad state of affairs with regard to crime that they've stopped reporting crimes. There are so many crimes and the police do nothing about it. Everybody's helpless, that people have stopped reporting crime. And therefore, it looks like there's less crime, but there is actually more. The problem with this argument is that even if it were true that people have stopped reporting crime to police because it's gotten so bad, we have what are called independent victimization surveys. The Bureau of Justice Statistics conducts an important one, and there are others. And that goes and just asks people a statistically significant sampling of folks, have you been the victim of, and do you know someone who has been the victim of all of these types of crime? And what we find is that the independent crime victimization surveys track the official crime data in parallel. So they have not presented any evidence that people no longer report crime. And we have evidence that the reported crime rates mirror those of independent victimization surveys. So that's not a very good argument for them. Second argument that they will make is that the data the FBI has simply isn't accurate because many police departments no longer trust the FBI, or for whatever reason, police departments aren't reporting their crime data to the FBI. The reality is that we have long debunked this. Number one, most police departments, if they want to maintain federal funding, are required by law to report crime data to state and federal agencies. If they aren't compliant, they can be penalized and lose federal funding. So it's just not true that willy-nilly police departments are sick of wokeness or something and they're no longer reporting crime statistics to the FBI. There's absolutely no evidence of that. And secondly, it is always the case that some departments don't report, either because their data is late, incomplete, they have exemptions, or whatever the case may be. But we have had that going on for decades. It is not a new thing that some police departments don't report their data. There certainly is no swelling of that number of police departments. So that's not a good argument. Argument number three that we will hear is that while overall crime rates maybe are down, certain areas or certain specific types of crime in certain areas will have increased. Well, it's certainly true that you can have a broader trend going one way and you can find locations where maybe it's going the opposite way. I mean, listen, Oklahoma City now has a higher crime rate than New York City. Oklahoma as a state now has a higher crime rate than New York as a state. Oklahoma's having a problem. But that doesn't change the fact that overall the crime rates are going down, and it simply shifts the areas where we should be focusing. And then number four is sort of like a catch-all when they've gone through number one, two, and three.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Excellencies, the horror must stop. It's high time for a ceasefire, along with the unconditional release of hostages. I welcome the peace initiative recently outlined by President Biden and urge all parties to seize this opportunity and come to an agreement.
As calls grow for Israel and Hamas to back a ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza, the World Health Organization's warning over 8,000 Palestinian children have been diagnosed with acute malnutrition. We'll speak to a top Palestinian diplomat at the United Nations and look at how there were more armed conflicts last year than in any other year since the end of World War II. But first, we look at the ethics crisis at the Supreme Court. We'll speak to a filmmaker who made headlines this week after she secretly recorded Justice Samuel Alito agreeing that the country should return to, quote, godliness.
There are differences on fundamental things that really can't be compromised. It really can't be compromised. So it's not like we're going to split the difference.
We'll also speak to a reporter at ProPublica who won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on Justice Clarence Thomas's long record of taking free trips from Harlan Crow and other Republican billionaire donors. Justice Alito also attacked ProPublica. We'll get Justin Elliott's response. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 37,200 people, nearly 16,000 of them children, with more than 85,000 injured. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, head of the World Health Organization, warned famine spreading in Gaza.
A significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions. Despite reports of increased delivery of food, there is currently no evidence that those who need it most are receiving sufficient quantity and quality of food.
This comes as deadly Israeli attacks continue across the Gaza Strip. Fresh attacks on the Nusayrat refugee camp have killed at least five people, while Israeli soldiers are using explosives to level buildings in the center of Rafah. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said this week he will confiscate some $35 million in Palestinian tax revenue and transfer the money to Israeli families who've lost relatives in Palestinian attacks. On the diplomatic front, world leaders from the G7 nations are meeting in Italy, where the U.S. says it'll push its allies to back its proposed Gaza ceasefire deal. Hamas has responded to the proposal, but on Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said some of the group's requested changes are not workable. Hamas responded in a statement, quote, "While Blinken continues to talk about Israel's approval of the proposal, we've not heard any Israeli official voicing approval," Hamas said. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives Wednesday voted to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over audio of President Biden's interview with Special Counsel Robert Hur. The Justice Department has already released the full transcript of the interview. Hur was tasked with investigating Biden's handling of classified material. He did not bring any charges against Biden, but Republicans claim they need the audio as part of their impeachment effort against the president. New York Democrat Jerry Nadler blasted his Republican colleagues as he spoke from the House floor.
The Judiciary Committee under Republican control has spent the last 18 months and $20 million taxpayer dollars in a desperate search to find something, anything, that they can use to damage President Biden and to protect Donald Trump.
The Justice Department, which Garland oversees, is not expected